listening to Everyday Engineering, the City of Madison's engineering podcast, where we talk about infrastructure. Complex topics explained simply. From the water that flows down your drain to the rain and snow that drains into the lakes. By way, the curbs and streets we design. City engineering touches your life in so many ways. Explained right now in Everyday Engineering. The lakes in the city of Madison are at the center of so many activities in the summer and the winter, all seasons really. But they're also at the center of a conversation when the lakes tend to turn a little greener and maybe not as pretty, maybe a little yucky. There's a reason behind all of that, and we have experts here to talk about that today. Joining us is stormwater engineer from the City of Madison Engineering Division, my colleague Phil Gabler, and today a research scientist from UW, Eric Booth. Thank you both for being here to talk lakes.
Thanks for the invitation.
Yes, of course. Before we get started, can you just kind of tell us a little bit about your background so you can introduce yourself to our listeners and viewers? Eric, you're the guest.
All right,
guest.
Sounds good.
Phil's our regular, which I always appreciate, but let's start with you.
Sure, yeah. So I like to consider myself first and foremost a hydrologist. So that's kind of water science, broadly speaking. And my background, actually, Phil and I went to grad school together in the engineering department, water resources engineering. So I've got an engineering background, and I've done work in ecology. I've tried to mix several different scientific disciplines together to kind of get a broader understanding of water issues, and certainly understanding urban settings, agricultural settings. Like, you really have to know what's going on the land. And in Wisconsin, obviously, we have a lot of agriculture, but we also have a lot of urban areas. So
yes.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's Eric Booth. What about you, Phil?
So I'm the water quality manager for the City of Madison. I also have a background in biological systems engineering, which is the new cool name for agricultural engineering. So I have a pretty good understanding of kind of the agricultural landscape as well. But I work on making sure that the water that comes out of the city is as clean as we can make it.
I think both of you just kind of hit on the fact that, you know, when water mixes with land, that's kind of what our conversation is about here today. A little bit, in my eyes, it feels that way just because of working with engineers day to day and understanding how water quality somewhat works on a basic level. I'm not nearly as engineering nerdy as you both are, which I appreciate your expertise is. So talk us through some of this. You know, I think when people think of the lakes, they think it's the hub of hangouts on the terrace. Let's go to the lake, the iconic view as you drive into the heart of the city. But as the summer kind of goes on, they do get a little more icky. First and obvious question, why?
I'll start out, but Phil can
maybe
jump
it's
in.
A loaded question.
Yeah.
I don't know, but there's a lot of different ways.
We only have 20 minutes here, and this is just a super complex, complicated, contentious issue.
Sure,
but I will try to do my best.
Okay.
What we typically think about in terms of kind of the clean lakes or lack of clean lakes is the driver of the nutrient phosphorus is what we think most about. So
Okay. There
are a lot of different ways you could describe water quality in the lake. Some people think about algae and kind of the lake looks mucky or not very clear, or others might think of weeds growing on the shoreline. So I think for this conversation, we're going to mostly talk about phosphorus and how it drives algae blooms.
Yes.
And those are really, I think, the most problematic aspects of what we think about when we think of water quality, because they can lead to what are called harmful algal blooms. And these are when you see kind of blue-green colors on the surface of the water when you're next to the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So phosphorus is our main concern. And so when we think about what's driving those lakes, it's excess phosphorus coming in from the landscape and kind of leading to these big booms and growth of these algae. And so, you know, nutrients in general and phosphorus specifically are important for plant growth, but like a lot of things, in excess, it can be a problem.
Yeah, Phil, I mean, do you want to elaborate? Also,
the only thing I say is just that the reason phosphorus is that important nutrient is that it's the limiting nutrient.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
if you think about
what does that mean?
If you're going to build a blob of algae, right? Think about it, if you had a Lego set, you have nitrogen and you have other elements that you need, and as you're pulling them out, every time you do it, you have to have the same ratio, mm-hmm. and you're going to always have infinite bins of the other stuff, but once you run out of phosphorus, you can't build any more algae.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of how I like to think about a limiting nutrient.
Yes, I thank you for that, and that's a really good visual, and I think helps non-engineering brains kind of understand it a little bit better. Where does it come from? Where does the phosphorus come from?
Yeah, so this is where we start getting into uncertainty,
okay.
and some contentiousness. And then we also need to talk about, like, how do we know these things?
Sure.
Like, I try to be introspective as much as possible as a scientist. So when we look at monitoring data, so we are very, very fortunate in the Madison area and the Ohara watershed to have decades of monitoring data along the streams and tributaries that drain into the lakes. And so some of those tributaries are dominated by agriculture, particularly the ones that come in from the northern side of Lake Mendota. And then we have a few in the urban settings, like Spring Harbor is one that we've had for a while. So looking at that monitoring data, we get a sense of how much is coming from these different land uses. And in general, it's about there's about twice as much phosphorus per acre coming from our agricultural land as there is from our urban settings. And there's a lot of variability, but that's roughly the number that we're dealing with. And so then when you consider that ratio roughly, then you need to think about, okay, what part of the landscape draining to these lakes is agriculture? What percent is urban? So for Mendota, I think it's around like 60% of the watershed is agricultural. But then when you start getting
60%?
Down 60% of what drains to Mendota is classified as agricultural.
And is that a lot in the grand, like, big picture? Is that a lot?
I mean, there are certainly watersheds in Wisconsin that are more dominated by agriculture.
Sure.
Yeah, it really just depends on where you are. I mean, Madison is unique that
we have farm all around us.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. We have this urban core, and that's what we experience, I guess, as urbanites the most. But yeah, you drive a little bit outside of town, especially to the north, it's dominated by agriculture and specifically kind of dairy agriculture. So, but as you go further down the lakes, like adding in the land that drains to Monona, you get a little bit more urban area. But if you look at, or if you just think about that ratio again, twice as much roughly per acre coming from ag as urban, and then there's just more ag mm-hmm. going into Mendota. Agriculture tends to be a higher source.
Sure.
I would say that's on the phosphorus end and the sediment end. Right? But there's other contaminants also that are not great for the lakes. And, you know, we're not going to get into all that today, but we're going to talk mostly on phosphorus and sediment. But those are our two big regulated things, right, from water quality. But they regulate the DNR, the DNR and the EPA look at sediment and phosphorus because it's something you can pretty easily measure.
Sure.
And if you grab sediment, you grab a lot of the nasty stuff that comes off of an urban setting.
So, okay. So, and this seems very, very simple, but for anybody who doesn't eat, breathe, and drink this topic all the time, what are you referring to when you say sediment?
So sediment.
Is it just rocks and dirt? It sounds like a very simple question, but like if people don't like listen and learn and read about this a lot, so you're talking about rocks and dirt? Or are you talking about other things?
Yeah, rocks and dirt, but then
I'm not afraid to ask the question.
Then we have to nerd it out a little bit.
Let's nerd it out.
We're in a specific particle size distribution curve, and in Wisconsin, that's gets to really, really tiny, tiny specks of dirt.
Mm-hmm.
That almost won't settle out. Like you can put them in a glass of water and they will just float around in the water for a long, long, long time, like, you know, a day.
Okay.
And those tend to be the things that really grab onto the nasty stuff too.
Okay. And nasty stuff being?
All the things we talked about already, phosphorus, but then heavy metals, PCBs, a whole laundry list of different acronyms coming from industrial sources.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I like to push Phil a little bit more because he knows that I want that. I need that to understand this fully, because if I don't understand it, anybody who's not an engineer probably doesn't either. So I will ask the question. And just if people are just joining us or listening to this, I want to be clear like what we're talking about. So 62-mile-long Yahara River that connects Lakes Mendota, Monona, Wingro, Wabisa, and Caganza. And it's a chain that winds through south central Wisconsin. So just wanted to kind of establish that. We didn't really say it. We kind of throw Mendota, Monona because we're local. But if someone's just listening to this and wants to understand, that's what we're talking about. We got a big old chain of lakes that we all love. How did we get to this point, I guess, with the lakes being, you know, maybe a little more icky? Did they always used to be this way?
Yeah, it's a fascinating history. I mean, it's really connected
maybe
to the kind of...
Maybe that's a whole nother episode.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But it's connected to the whole development of the city and the urban growth. But for a while, well, I guess to go in sequence quickly, you had European American settlers kind of coming to the region mid-1800s. And actually, agricultural development in terms of land base, kind of for cropland, peaked around 1870, 1880. Which is quite a while ago, and it's been in a slow decline ever since. But that first kind of changing of the prairie oak savanna to cropland really led to a lot of erosion, and so you had this kind of first big pulse of sediment going into the lakes, and you can see that in these cores that you can bring up from the bottom of the lake pretty clearly. So that wasn't great. We don't have, you know, data from as far back as the mid-1800s, but we start getting data actually in the early 1900s, and there were algal blooms back then. So first driven by some of that erosion, and of course there's phosphorus attached to that sediment. But then as the urban area grew, wastewater management was a huge challenge. And it gets gross, but it's important to talk about, like, what did we do with our waste? And not just human waste, but we're talking horses back then were a huge source of waste. All of that ended up going into the lake. And at first, it was kind of diffuse. What do people do with their waste? They kind of throw it out the window, put it in the backyard. Like, it diffuses and spreads into the lake when it rains.
Sure.
But then after a while, they even tried to pipe it into the lake as we started getting plumbing in houses, which made it even worse, right? We're just pushing it out really quickly. Mm-hmm. The lakes looked terrible at that point. It wasn't necessarily phosphorus that was a problem. It was just the organic matter that required a lot of oxygen to decompose.
Right.
These lakes were in rough, rough shape. Sure. So that led to huge technological change in wastewater treatment, and Madison has really led the way almost globally in some of that development, and it was kind of out of necessity because it was such a SHIT show at the time. So big changes. We eventually treated that wastewater at a couple of different places, and then we ended up making a treatment plant down at Nine Springs, which is where our wastewater goes today, in the 30s. And we treat that water, send it around the lakes. So now our wastewater, our treated wastewater, doesn't even go into the lakes. All right, so that's no longer a major source.
Sure.
But about the time that we made those big advances in the mid-1900s, that's when agriculture really started to be kind of industrialized. And we started using a lot more fertilizer. We started producing more livestock and dairy in the watershed. And so that kind of replaced the wastewater sources with kind of these agricultural sources of phosphorus. And so that's what we've been dealing with for well over 50 years as the primary contributor to nutrients and phosphorus to the lakes.
Sure. Phil?
I'm going to say a little bit, you know,
because
I've been sitting here for a while and I got to say something.
Sorry.
But also in that, no problem
this
at all.
This is important,
but
though.
In that agricultural, right, raising dairy, in the agricultural landscape, right? You can have a lot of cows in an area, like when you get a lot of manure, right? Cows are really good at making manure. And then it makes a lot of sense to use that manure to then fertilize your corn. And if you put down manure to meet all the nitrogen requirements of your corn, you put down extra phosphorus. and that extra phosphorus then builds up in the soil. So there's some areas where you've been over applying manure from a phosphorus lens for a long time, and so there's these kind of pockets of really, really high phosphorus out in the landscape, and then when you have erosion, all that gets washed into the lake where it becomes food for algae as opposed to food for corn. Mm. All right, so there's these little pockets of kind of time bombs out there that then get triggered when we have big rain events.
Sure, sure. And again, like, I don't think we can talk about the lakes without talking about the impacts. Like, we are going, like, I didn't anticipate it being so heavy on the impacts from agriculture, but I think it's obviously a conversation, you have to include it. I mean, you can't ignore it. So here's the next quick thing is, there's a group that works with, you know, the agriculture community and lake, and there's all sorts of initiatives going on, correct?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, so it kind of...
We don't have to, like, go into deep mm-hmm. about that, but I just want to make sure, because this isn't just us being like, da-da-da-da-da, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this has been a long-term conversation between various groups over the years, the city, the county, working with the agricultural community to try and reduce these kind of flushes of phosphorus that come off the agricultural landscape whenever it rains.
Sure.
So today there's groups like the Clean Lakes Alliance that are really trying to forge strong relationships across these different groups. But I will say, you know, we've put a lot of effort over the last few decades into it, and there's been a lot of important kind of conservation practices implemented, and certainly there are a lot of farmers that are kind of pushing their practices to the edge in terms of, like, good, really good conservation, and not always getting rewarded financially for doing it. But at the same time, we haven't really noticed measurable change in the amount of phosphorus that has gone into the lakes. We've been pretty much at this flat line for almost 3-4 decades.
Okay.
And it's been just been frustrating to watch. So there's all this work, good work going on the ground. Why is there just no progress? And it's a lot of different drivers. One of them being we're seeing more rainfall today. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about rainfall being a major driver of mm-hmm. phosphorus from land to water. And if we're getting more rain, we're just going to likely get more phosphorus. But we've also added a lot more dairy cows to the watershed, and that makes it more of a challenge to manage their manure. Mm-hmm. We've also pushed the urban fringe into agricultural land, which makes it harder to spread manure, and it concentrates manure in fewer areas. And there's just been kind of historical kind of loss of wetlands, and we're starting to restore more here and there. So all those kind of drivers mixed together to kind of lead to this flat line. So we're still seeking kind of big ideas, transformative ideas to really move the needle on reducing phosphorus.
Got it.
So there yes. are groups interested in transformative. Maybe just make one quick plug.
Yes.
I'm a part of a project called Grassland 2.0, and we're trying to figure out ways to increase perennial agriculture on the landscape and the watershed. And so one of these ways could be getting some of the dairy heifers, so these are the younger cows before they are lactating, get them onto well-managed pasture in the watershed. And what that perennial grass does is it holds onto the soil, it prevents erosion, and you're not fertilizing these mm-hmm. pastures as much compared to, say, corn. So just one idea to try and get a little bit get a landscape that is not losing as much phosphorus.
Where does chloride come into all this with the lakes?
Go for it, Phil.
Right, chloride, most of the chloride in the lakes, almost all of the chloride in the lakes comes from either road salt application mm-hmm. or from potash, which is potassium chloride, which is a fertilizer out in the agricultural landscape. Chloride doesn't really impact the phosphorus that's in the lake that much.
Okay.
But one thing we are finding is that it makes the detention basins in an urban setting that we spend a lot of time, money, and effort putting in and maintaining, yes. it makes them work worse. It causes anoxic zones, so that means no oxygen down at the bottom of the lake. And then that phosphorus that's stuck on those tiny little particles of dirt, it says, I'm out of here. And it gets into the water column, and then you can flush that out into the lake, and then it's basically liquid Kool-Aid for the algae. Right? It's like, I guess all Kool-Aid is, no, I guess we have powdered Kool-Aid. It is they instant like it. Food, right? They like it.
They like it, yes. Okay, so chloride's not helping our cause.
It is not helping our cause, and basically with chloride, the only real solution is use the least amount possible, and that goes for streets, sidewalks, and water softeners. All of those things come together.
Salt, for anybody who's not sure what that is. Okay.
And maybe more on the, this links with drinking water as well. But what concerns a lot of people with chloride is that we're seeing chloride concentrations slowly increasing through time in our drinking water. And that's just something, it's hard to treat. Mm-hmm. Desalinization is a very energy intensive process. We're not there yet. But at some point those numbers get into kind of public health risks.
Yes. We are up on time. This is so informative. Can we start over every season and try again next year? Does it go away? Does it, like, it sounds, again, a very simple question.
Boy,
but
I wish.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could just, okay, you know, water just calms down, freezes, everything dies with the bad phosphorus and the things that, you know, I don't know. Anybody who's not, again, eating, drinking, breathing this, it seems like it'd be that simple, but it's not.
So, yeah, there's...
And this is our last question.
Sure. So, in terms of phosphorus, what we see sometimes in the really dry years, so just last year, for instance, we didn't have much rain, we didn't have much runoff, and we didn't see as much phosphorus going into the lake. Those types of years, we tend to see a little better water quality. There are a lot of other factors that kind of drive water quality in the lake, but in general... and that kind of indicates that, yeah, if we turn off that phosphorus, we can see noticeable change. But at the same time, we have what's called legacy sources of phosphorus throughout the watershed. Phil talked about kind of accumulating phosphorus in the soil through time. We also have a lot of phosphorus in our wetlands. And that's just going to take a lot of time for it to move through the system. One other quick project that Dane County has been involved in is called Suck the Muck.
Yes.
And if, yeah, so
Google what, that if yeah, you want to learn more about that.
So that's actually physically removing that legacy source of phosphorus from some of the tributaries north of Mendota. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot of innovative things going on to try and treat these legacy sources, but it just makes the problem longer term in terms of fixing it. And it's challenging.
So we can't start over. Phil, you get the last word. Anything else you want to add?
I just want to end on a note of there's a lot of work going into fixing the phosphorus problem, right? We understand that it is an issue. The community understands that. There's a lot of people. There's adaptive management, which we don't have time for today. But basically, the whole community is working together, both urban and agriculture, to find these practices that keep the phosphorus where it can do good work. Because we actually are really, really lucky that we have too much phosphorus. I would say it's better to have too much phosphorus than not enough from the overall like worldview. There's a really good book, The Devil's Element by Dan Egan. Read that. It will make you look at phosphorus a different way, even if you know as much as Eric and I do.
I love a
it's
good book.
It's fascinating.
Yes.
And I think we're going to, you know, we're going to keep moving in the right direction here.
Yeah.
Will there be setbacks? Are there changes in our weather patterns and our rainfall that might make that treadmill go a little faster? Yeah, but we'll get stronger. We'll get better. I think we're going to move in the right direction. We learn things every year. And so everyone can do their little bit. In the urban setting, the little bit you can do is rake your leaves out of the street in the fall before it rains. That's the number one thing that a resident in an urban setting can do. In the agricultural setting, I think it comes down to like controlling erosion, cover crops, and manure management.
Yeah, more perennial vegetation on the ground in general is a good way to do it.
Love that. Anything else? Anything else for now? We'd definitely have to have you both back. Anything else?
I would just say if you're an urban dweller in the watershed, just start engaging with the agricultural community and it's a big system. It's a really big system to try and change. Like, we're talking about policies not only at the county or state level, but at the national level that are really driving what happens on our agricultural land. And a lot of the practices and behavior that happens on agricultural land is not because, you know, the farmers are not doing the right thing intentionally. It's really a product of what the system is asking of them. Which again, we could get into a lot more information, but just in general, I would really encourage people to engage with like the Farm Bill mm-hmm. and some of these other policies that drive what our agricultural landscape looks like.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you for sharing the information in your brains. I think I pulled out as much as I could in like 20 minutes. If you have an idea for an upcoming podcast episode, or you have a question or anything along those lines, please follow us on social media. You can just search Madison, City of Madison Engineering Division on X, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, because as always, we're here for you every day in engineering.